Vegas that season. I'm sure the residual hormones used for harvesting my eggs had something to do with it. It was tiring, and the arid and airless atmosphere of Vegas left me dry of any enthusiasm. I had also decided to quit smoking once and for all, galvanized by self-loathing for not tending to my own body. I was disgusted with all the habits of my past. Ironically, Las Vegas is the only place you can smoke everywhere and anywhere you want. I had had enough, and the clouds of smoke I was forced to walk through on my way to my room only reminded me of my own tacit, self-destructive past. It was surprisingly easy to quit. I had quit once before, when Salman and I were first living together because of his asthma. Then when he wasn't around, I picked it up again. It seemed I could worry about his health, but somehow not about my own. We throw ourselves away, a little each day. Dr. Sechkin and I continued working diligently to set up the foundation after I completed filming the Las Vegas season. I was triumphant from quitting smoking and determined not to fall off the wagon again. Back in New York, my spirits lifted. I briefly saw both Adam and Teddy in the same week in June 2009. Overall, I felt a little like Wonder Woman, invincible. It was a period of productivity and creativeness and also a newfound general optimism. I hadn't felt like this for several years. That same spring, buoyed by the energy of helping to launch the EFA and finding my voice, I also managed to somehow launch an entirely new venture, a fine jewelry collection for Bergdorf Goodman. I had been designing jewelry for personal use for years, and I was itching to do it more, professionally. Many years earlier, as a favor to a friend, I had agreed to meet a young jewelry designer named Tara Famiglietti. A willowy slip of a girl, with fine blonde hair hanging loose around her high, prominent cheekbones, Tara has the biggest, bluest eyes I have ever seen. While she is staggeringly beautiful, at the time she had a sadness in her expression that moved me deeply. When she first showed up at my door with some of her samples, she looked cool and casually chic in that way that girls in Paris and London do. Soon after that first meeting, we became fast friends. I very quickly learned that her father, with whom she had been quite close, had just passed. She was also having a bit of man trouble. Tara and I found it very easy to confide in each other. I have always had very tight, long-lasting friendships with women, and often these women have been instrumental in my life. I sensed I could be that kind of friend for her at that time. I began commissioning custom jewelry from Tara, starting with pieces for my wedding, modern interpretations of traditional Indian jewelry. I would also come to wear many of her delicate creations on the red carpet. Later, when I started filming the next season of Top Chef, I realized that many pieces in my own jewelry collection weren't right for what I was doing on TV. I wanted to design a capsule collection for personal use that would better fit my new role as host. I didn't much like what I was finding in my closet or in the shops then. I wanted pieces that adorned the body, highlighted the nape of the neck or the small of the back, pieces that had movement and light but didn't upstage me, making too much noise at judges' table or look inappropriate in the kitchen. I knew Tara was the only person to translate my vision. My rapport with Tara isn't only emotional or sisterly. It's also similar to the relationship many women in India have with trusted jewelers and other artisans who come to the house to collaborate on family pieces. Whenever a member of our family had a jewel to be made or a stone to be set or reset because someone had died and left the stone or there was an impending wedding and we needed to round out someone's trousseau, we called our family jeweler Mr. Money from Kerala Jewelers. He had a slight tremor in his hands and dark chocolate skin, the texture of time-worn leather. He wore his white hair back-combed and brill-creamed, and was always dressed in plaid dhotis, or men's sarongs. His magical toolbox fascinated me. Wooden with a complex hinge, it unfolded into a mini-desk at which he sat on the floor on our veranda. His box was not unlike my grandparents' Godridge, containing secrets and drawers I longed to pull open. I loved watching him work, meticulously, with all his tiny tools and files. He would first sketch a simple pencil drawing, based on my grandmother's descriptions of what she wanted a given piece to look like. Mr. Money, whose name literally meant jewel, worked quietly and methodically, never flinching as my grandmother insisted he had misinterpreted her extremely precise directions. Jewelry signifies so much more than self-adornment in Indian culture. The pieces serve as personal talismans, and the women in my family take the subject as seriously as they do their cooking or how they fold their saris. I love Tara's hand and the way she interpreted and executed what was in my head so deftly. It felt like she had had the same intuition Mr. Money had. The pieces Tara created for me to wear on Top Chef looked nothing like what she designed for her own line, but were something new and different, something immediately mine. We had an amazing shorthand between us, and often we finished each other's sentences. Frank Bruni of the New York Times had spent several column inches in the paper dissing my sartorial choices when reviewing my first season on Top Chef. It had seemed unnecessarily cruel to me at the time, and it still stung several seasons later. I am sure his slight was part of the impetus for my calling on Tara to design my accessories with me. It frustrated me that as a woman, I had so much more attention focused on how I looked than, say, Tom, our head judge, did. But in hindsight, perhaps Bruni did me a favor. Whatever the origin, I loved making jewelry. Bruni was not the first person to skewer me in the Times, though. No, Guy Trebé had that honor when he mused in the style section on the reason for my appearances at the Bryant Park fashion shows, deriding me as a brand-name goddess and semi-celebrated hustler, and failing, of course, to mention what I had told him. That I was there for the same reason he was, to report on the clothes for Harper's Bazaar, in my style column. That article came out long before I started filming Top Chef, but it was from that point forward that I started to really struggle with developing a thick skin against media attention. Fortunately, as Top Chef progressed, most of the feedback from actual everyday viewers of the show was quite positive. Plus, real professionals in the food world seem increasingly to enjoy and appreciate the show. Top Chef made me both happy and taught me much. But I was itching to do something creative in addition to my TV work, to explore other facets of my interests. A few random people had seen the pieces I wore and asked where to find them. Slowly, I also had girlfriends and other TV people ask whether they could borrow them. With a bit of money left over from my Pantene contract, I designed a small collection of samples to add to what I already wore on the show, with Tara as my technical hands. Now emboldened but largely ignorant of how to run a business, I somehow thought we could start a company, basically out of my kitchen sink. At the time, I had a spunky and sweet assistant named Shayna, who was a talented photographer and wonderfully creative. She shot the samples for our lookbook and other materials, and we called the company the Padma Collection. The three of us worked elbow to elbow, out of my tiny writing room, until I rented out the place on the sixth floor above my apartment as an office. It was getting pretty cramped in my writing room with all our raw materials, molds and computers, Tara's tools and Shayna's camera equipment. The upstairs apartment served not only as an office, but as a beautiful showroom too. And the big open kitchen it had was perfect for testing recipes. The showroom was also a good meeting place for the foundation's board, as up until then we'd been meeting in Sechkin's waiting room. With all that was going on, I got it into my head that we should have the office blessed, as I had done for every place I had ever lived, except my marital home. My ex-husband was a staunch fundamentalist atheist and had no patience for worshiping God in any form. I'm pretty secular, but didn't mind hedging my bets. I called a couple of priests from my temple, and they came in from Queens to bless our new space. They brought fresh mango leaves, coconuts, and various idols in camphor to burn during the puja. My cousin Rajini and her husband came to the blessing, with their infant son Siddhanth, dressed in traditional clothing, looking every bit the perfect little Brahmin boy, with a customary horizontal three lines of vibhuti streaked across his forehead. It was wonderful to see young hipster Shaina sitting cross-legged next to the Vaishjid priests as they chanted in Sanskrit on the rooftop of our Alphabet City digs. It was moving to share a deeper part of my own heritage with Tara, who had been one of the people who had quietly helped me pack up to move into the Surrey just 2 years earlier, when I was too weak from surgery to do it alone. I watched the smiling face of Michelle, my makeup artist, with pleasure as I bounced and held my nephew in my arms. Michelle had been and would be with me through so many seasons of Top Chef, by my side for the most challenging days, like in Vegas when I almost threw up on camera from the heat, crippling menstrual cramps, and too much food for one person to consume. She had patched up my streaming eyes when I could not stop crying behind the set's kitchen door because of how much I still missed my husband. Through the smoky haze of incense, I watched my cousin Rajini instinctively rise and bend to get whatever the priest needed at exactly the right moment. In a way that I couldn't, because I had left India before I could properly learn the technicalities of such rituals. She stepped in gracefully and silently, and made everything so seamless as her sari rustled about her. Like Neela, Rajini had always been more of a sister to me. She has been there for almost every milestone of my life, observing and playing her part in the hierarchy of our family. Her life had been so different from mine. She and her husband, Anant, whom we had all known since we were kids, had lived in the old neighborhood since childhood, until they moved to the States as adults just a few years before. I couldn't help thinking about how differently my life might have turned out if my parents, like hers, had had a happy marriage. Who would I have become if my mother and I had never immigrated to the States? My work in food, fashion, and now in jewelry was definitely a result of all my travels, of the commingling of cultural influences I got to experience, because I'd always had one foot in the East and one foot in the West. At that moment, I gave thanks for all the circumstances of my life that brought me there, to that very place in the East Village. I was happy in our treehouse workshop, with friends, family, and worker bees around me. It felt good to hear Sanskrit echo in that office, and it comforted me to bring the various aspects of my current life together with the deepest spiritual origins of where I had come from. Like many immigrants, I had always kept my Eastern and Western lives compartmentalized. Not since I had left the comfort of my home and my marriage had I felt a cohesiveness of being, a joining of my two very real identities. In that moment, finally, my American self and my Indian self were totally at peace as one. Chapter 12. Those first 6 months of 2009 were so busy, so productive, that time seemed to move faster than usual, and so I didn't notice at first when my period was late. I could hardly keep track of what day it was already. Like so many women, I had spent my entire sexual life trying not to get pregnant. My mother had always reminded me of her exceptional fertility. She had only one child, but my conception had been on the first try. It could be hereditary, she'd warned me. Be careful. And so I had been. But that had been before the fertility specialist's frank appraisal of my reproductive system. And though his conclusion had devastated me, it had also freed me from the worry of using birth control. Small consolation, but some nonetheless. For the previous 6 months, I had been less careful than I'd been in the past. I had been pretty much told there was no way I could conceive after all. At least, not the old-fashioned way. But I was late, and despite the endo, I had always been regular, like clockwork. Was it possible? Could I be pregnant? I called Dr. Sechkin. He sighed sweetly and told me to come in for a sonogram. Lying there, my stomach coated in jelly, I stared at the screen showing a hazy image of my uterus. I watched him whack the side of the monitor with his palm, as you would an old TV. "You see this area?" he said, pointing. If you were pregnant, you would see a black spot right here. I saw nothing. I joked that maybe I had a hysterical pregnancy. Not hysterical, he said. Wishful. Another week and no period. Yet strangely, I had many of its symptoms. I felt tired. I was ravenous. My boobs were sore and swollen. Confused, I called my friend Sharon, who told me her early pregnancy symptoms mimicked those of her period. I thought about calling my mother, but worried that she'd be too emotional. I needed someone who could maintain a clinical reserve, so I called my Aunt Premi, a psychiatrist, who urged me to get a blood test to be sure. I finally gave in and asked my mom about her pregnancy. Patty, I can't remember, she told me. That was 40 years ago. Thanks for the reminder, Mom. I called Sechkin's office again. He was away in Iceland on a conference. I filled Kim in from his office, who told me to come in for a blood test, and added in excitement, I'm so happy you're trying. But I wasn't trying. Several fretful days after the blood test, I got a call from a strange number. I was in a rush as usual, my hair sopping wet, late for an interview with TV Guide and after lunch with the editor-in-chief. I picked up the call. It was Sechkin calling from Iceland. Padma, you must come here, he said, the bad reception thickening his charming Turkish accent. It's like being on another planet. Is that why you're calling? I asked. To tell me about Iceland? Padma, I'm standing on a glacier in the full glory of Mother Nature. I knew then. By this point, I had known Sechkin for years. I was well acquainted with the genuine sense of amazement that medicine and the human body inspired in him, even after decades of practice. I knew he wouldn't tell me this news from inside his hotel room. He had wanted to be in a miraculous place when he told me of my own miracle. Sechkin forbade me from telling anyone yet. The risk of miscarriage for all women in the very early stages of pregnancy is higher than most of us realize. Unnervingly so for women of my age. And because miscarriage is often a private tragedy, few of us understand that seeing a plus sign on your EPT is not the end of the story that movies make it out to be. I hung up the phone, still in a daze. I slipped on pants, made one last attempt to dry my hair, raced downstairs, and hailed a cab. In the quiet of the car, in what felt like the longest cab ride of my life, the news hit me at last. I couldn't stop smiling. Hearing doctors tell you you can't get pregnant does not extinguish the hope. Only after months of wrestling with the idea had I been able to haul the news of my infertility from the abstract and into reality. I had just begun to accept it, to make plans that took it into account. Now that mental struggle was abruptly ended. I was purely, simply, happy. I wanted so badly to tell someone, but I couldn't call anyone from the cab. Though I'm on TV, I can still walk the streets of New York, more or less anonymously. Among cab drivers, however, many of whom are from the subcontinent, I'm frequently recognized. Highly personal conversations are a no-no. So I was especially thrilled that my friend Christina was joining me for the interview. I got out of the cab, took her aside, and whispered my news. I felt giddy at hearing the words come out of my mouth out loud. Christina's eyes got very wide, and she beamed a smile from ear to ear. After the meeting, a question began to nag at my giddiness. Not so much how, but the far more uncomfortable who. This the tabloids would soon address with their usual delicacy. I never announced my pregnancy. I started showing and the press figured out in the way they often do, with absurd speculation that's wrong until it's not. Just after the Emmys in late September, a New York tabloid ran the article. She's pregnant, accompanied by a photo of me standing beside my cousin Manu on a red carpet with my hand resting near my belly. And that's the father, the headline read. Unaccustomed to brilliant tabloid guesswork, Manu was horrified. After the initial speculation, the press wouldn't stop harping on the fact that I hadn't revealed the name of the father of my child. This prying and scrutinizing of my personal life in the pages of the tabloids was beyond anything I had previously experienced. The truth was that I didn't know the paternity myself until late that September. That early fall, I was feeling pretty shaky. Guilt and the shame of how I had not only hurt Teddy and Adam, but had also effectively embarrassed my whole extended family, swirled around in my head, mixing with the undeniable joy and elation that I would, incredibly, be a mother after all. My emotions blew hot and cold simultaneously, and I couldn't tell what was due to my fluctuating hormones and what was due to the very real and complicated facts of my life, induced by my own cavalier insistence on doing whatever I wanted. Even though my doubts about my future with Teddy lingered, I found myself wishing desperately that he was the father. The fact of this should have told me all I needed to know about my feelings for him. But before I could take that line of thought any further, I had to tell him my news. My miracle in one breath, an uncomfortable truth in the next. I told him about 2 weeks after I found out. He had been in London with his sons and my cousin Manu, who had by this time finished law school and started working with Teddy in his office. Teddy had wanted us to have a baby together. We had even discussed the idea months before, when I had my first egg frozen. "Why don't we just inseminate those eggs and get on with it?" he asked. My answer then was the same as when he'd suggested we get married the year before. "Let's wait a little and see." This became a refrain for me. Teddy, always decisive, would counter, "I don't exactly have time to waste, do you?" Now I would tell him that against all odds I was pregnant, and that there was a good chance the baby wasn't his. We had been open about everything. He knew every doubt I had about our relationship. He knew that, at times, I was seeing someone else. Still, none of this would cushion the blow. Because for there to be doubt about the paternity, I had to have been with both men within a week or two. Who wouldn't be hurt to hear that? When I told Teddy, I had to quickly follow the good news with the excruciatingly bad news. He was, understandably, very, very angry. I saw his face go white, and then beet red. He started to pace vigorously in the small living room of my apartment. It was as if the room could not contain him, or if his body could not contain his fury at the information he had just received. He yelled for some time, the first and only time he had ever spoken harshly to me, hurling insults my way. He did not say he would leave me, but he wanted no part of any scenario that included Adam. He had been aware of Adam, and while I saved him the details, I had been quite frank with him all along. I think he assumed my dalliance with Adam was something I had to get out of my system, or would grow out or tire of. He was enraged. He wanted to punch something, he said, but didn't know where to turn. He needed to leave my home to blow off the steam that was quickly rising, but I wouldn't let him out of the house for fear of what trouble he would get into. Hot, heavy tears rolled down my swollen cheeks as I barred the elevator door with my body. In that moment, the sudden rush of how badly I had squandered the love and kindness this man had shown me began to sink in. I had no choice but to bear the full brunt of the consequences of my actions. I had to help Teddy express and expel the utter disgust he felt for me and the situation. I did everything I could to keep him in my home. I didn't want him to have to deal with this alone or with anyone else. "What would they say to him anyway? I told you so? That girl is trouble? Get as far away from that mess as soon as possible." Teddy did not waver from what he believed, even in that bind. When I said I didn't know what to do yet and had to sort things out, he jumped at me without blinking. "The only thing, Padma, that would be worse than this, that I will never forgive you for, is not keeping this baby. I will never speak to you again if that happens." This caught me off guard. even though I knew full well about his feelings on the subject of abortion and a woman's right to choose. It was certainly another issue we differed vehemently on, but I was startled by his aggressiveness and his assumption that that's what I would resort to, the easy way out. But who could blame him? Sometimes we kid ourselves when we imagine our lives, expecting that everything will neatly fall into place. In my case, I had expected to meet someone who was, quote, appropriate, and who I deemed a good match, fall in love with him, and then start a family with him before my biological clock stopped ticking. For whatever reason, Teddy had fallen into my life and would not leave. Adam had come into it, too, and kept reappearing. Or for some reason, I kept drawing him back to me. I had assumed a future with either man made no sense, little knowing how important a role each one would play in my life. When I told Adam the news, he didn't know what to do. I'd broken things off with him that past February, and the hard truth was that we hadn't seen each other since, except for the moment we had fallen back together briefly in June. Adam had moved back to Texas and on with his life. I couldn't blame him. Teddy had implored me not to even involve Adam and was frustrated and angry when I did. Teddy had to overcome not only his own anger and pain, but also the embarrassment I had caused him publicly, which the press only magnified all over the world. The only thing that was missing from this emotionally nauseating picture was morning sickness, for which I was very glad indeed. I respected Adam's wishes to be left out of things, for a few weeks, but then couldn't contain myself any longer. I had grown up without knowing my real father. My grandfather and the rest of my family had, in their fury, ripped up every wedding photo that had ever existed, and so I had no idea what my father looked like. For so much of my life, there had been huge gaps in the information about my lineage, a whole side of my genealogy that no one wanted to discuss. I remember going out to eat chaat with Nila as a child and looking around at all of the men who would be about my father's age. I wondered if any of them could be him. Did I look like him? I'd always wondered how my life would have been had I known my father and felt wanted by him. I wanted my child to know exactly where she had come from, and to know that she was very wanted indeed. I didn't want my child to have the same identity crisis or hole in her sense of belonging as I did. I realized that asking one man to stay with me, in spite of my carrying another's child, and asking another man to be involved with the child I was carrying, even though I did not want to be involved with him, was expecting a lot. But I knew that this was the right path for me, and the baby, though I could not tell if I'd be able to will this situation into existence. I also thought it would haunt both Adam and me if we concealed the baby's true paternity. Adam had always expressed a strong desire to start a family. Both his brothers had several children, and he longed to have his own. Thinking about how hurt he must be, about the fact that this was not how he wanted to start a family, and that it was out of his control, I couldn't blame him for reacting the way he did. I spent many nights in my East Village apartment, tossing and turning in bed, unable to sleep. I hadn't wanted to hurt anyone, only to have some space and freedom without a commitment. But I had hurt two people immensely. I had tried very hard to restart my life on my own terms. I would have never planned on having a baby this way, but I wasn't sorry she was here, in my belly. I resolved to do everything for the good of this child. I knew I'd have to face the full brunt of all the gossip and embarrassment, the awkwardness and complicated circumstances around this pregnancy. So be it. I would take my medicine now, as much as I could, up front. So privately, Teddy took a paternity test. Teddy asked Dr. Setchkin to tell him directly, so he didn't have to hear the news from me. He was worried about his reaction if it turned out he wasn't the father, and he wanted to be able to process the information without fear of upsetting me. The news was not in his favor. Teddy got the results while I was in California for the Emmys. Top Chef was nominated again. I was in my suite at the Chateau Marmont, feeling tired as I looked down from my balcony at all the Hollywood revelers in the garden below. The days before the Emmys are a marathon of luncheons and parties. My feet were hurting, and I had no enthusiasm for joining in the festivities. I just wanted to know if Teddy was the father of my child. I went back into my room and dialed Dr. Sechkin's cell phone. Low and heavy, Sechkin's voice, when he said my name, told me everything I needed to hear. The sound of a woman laughing filtered in from the garden. I returned to New York that following Monday. In a moment of great sadness and disappointment, Teddy implored me to keep the results between us. He said he would raise her as his own, whether he and I ended up together or not. But I couldn't subject my child to that fate, nor could I do that to Adam, however I felt about him. Teddy was broken when I refused. I thought I'd lost him then. Now I needed to tell Adam. His initial reaction just to the news of my pregnancy had not exactly been happy. I dreaded telling him and kept procrastinating. Finally, weeks later, in November, when I could stand it no longer, I insisted he visit me in person, so I could let him know he was the father. Up until very late in the pregnancy, we couldn't agree on what we would do. How involved would Adam be in the baby's life? He'd always wanted to be a dad, but he did not at all look forward to being a dad to a child who already had her own family. We spent hours on the phone trying to talk through the different scenarios. I wanted an option where I stayed with Teddy, but Adam would still be a part of the baby's life, and our child would know she was loved by everyone. I didn't want to lie about who her father was, but I also didn't want to lose Teddy. I had finally realized the high caliber of the man I had before me. I now had to set about making sure I did what was best for the baby, while also making sure Teddy understood how grateful I was that he had stayed by my side. I did not take that second chance lightly. Sometime in early December, Teddy went with me to get a sonogram. Generally, I went either with my cousin Manu or with a girlfriend, Michelle, maybe. This time, no one was free to accompany me. Usually I could feel the baby kick or move from side to side, but for a few days I felt no movement at all. I felt uneasy going alone. Teddy overheard me on the phone to Sechkin, saying I was very worried. I had been feeling uncomfortable and getting larger. I hung up and looked at him silently. He was reading the paper, and I could see him trying to figure out in his head whether he was ready for this. The moment seemed very long, with him pondering whether he could actually stomach it, and me trying to summon up the courage to actually ask him out loud. I asked half-heartedly, sheepishly. Teddy was woefully delinquent in attending his own yearly checkups. He hated doctors and any and all medical stuff. But he was a gentleman above all else, especially when it came to women. And he could rarely refuse helping someone in need. He acquiesced with the same enthusiasm of a person scheduling a colonoscopy. His expression told me that for him the only thing worse than going was not going. He met me at Dr. Sechkin's office, around the corner from his apartment on Fifth Avenue. It was awkward at first. He didn't know what to expect, and I didn't know what I could expect of him. Maybe he would just sit in the waiting room. When we got there, two or three other women were reading magazines in the waiting area. I was directed to a small examination room, and after a glimpse at the waiting room, every seat full with a woman waiting to see the doctor, he quickly followed me in. To Teddy, the only fate worse than being confronted with all the gory details of my condition was being subjected to the curious eyes of all those hormonal women outside. This was the first time Teddy had seen the inside of a fully functioning gynecologist's office in all his 70 years. The office had been closed when he had his blood taken for the paternity test. The exam room was very small, about 7 by 8 feet, and very brightly lit, too brightly lit. There was a small stool on wheels tucked to the left of the exam table, and little floor space for anything else. I lay on the table and pulled my jeans down. I lifted up my sweater and scooched higher up on the table. I had been to these sonogram appointments so often that by now I just skipped the step of putting on the paper gown to stay warmer in the room. The sound of the crumpling and tearing of the thin paper sheet underneath me seemed obnoxiously loud. Teddy shifted from one foot to the other, visibly uncomfortable. He didn't know where to stand. He didn't know where to look. To my left was the sonogram screen. Teddy stood next to it, leaning against the wall by the door. Perhaps he felt this was a safe place for him, since he would have to completely turn away from me to see into my womb on the screen. Teddy suffered from vertigo, and I knew that look, but now he was also suffering from claustrophobia. A tear rolled down my left temple, along my hairline, and into my ear. He gently grabbed my hand. His hand felt heavy, soft, warm and large, with calluses at the base of his fingers from years of golf and tennis. Setchin came in and Teddy stiffened. He had gone from trying to reassure me back to stoicism in a flash. Good old Setchkin understood the emotional subtleties of men accompanying women in my condition to his office. And, of course, Setchkin was fully aware of the delicate circumstances, too. He deftly handled Teddy's presence with wisdom, compassion, and grace. Setchkin gently asked Teddy to move the other side of the exam bed so he could reach the machine and the wand connected to it. Teddy obliged. This time, I searched for Teddy's hand. The cold jelly squirted onto my abdomen made a farting noise coming out of the bottle, breaking the tension in the room. Setchkin laughed and said, "Sorry," then moved to the sonogram screen, shifting it for better viewing from his and Teddy's perspective. My eyes were glued to the monitor, but I was also acutely aware of the weight of Teddy's hand in mine. "There, here we go," said Setchkin. Teddy had been looking down at his shoes, but now looked up at the screen.
"What is that?" he asked.
"It's her heart," I answered. I squeezed his hand, and we both saw her tiny heart pulsing away on the screen, he for the first time.
"All good," Setchkin pronounced in his sing-song Turkish lilt.
I was scared Teddy wouldn't be able to handle it. There was a good chance he could walk out of that exam room and out of my life forever. I was also worried that the growing existence of this child would continually be a reminder of how I had hurt him, and of the embarrassment my actions had caused him. Seeing the growing baby in my womb could make it all too real for him. It could have scared him away. Who could blame him? Why would he still want to be involved with this mixed-up woman who had caused him so much pain? Most men would have run the other way. But Teddy wasn't most men. And I suppose I, too, needed to know if he was going to stay or go before the baby came. I had had no guarantees from Teddy up to that point, only a sincere promise to try to make the best of the very hard position I had put him in. There we were, holding hands and looking at this new life, willing herself into the universe through me. Once I saw that the baby was indeed okay, I couldn't take my eyes off Teddy. It did something to him, to witness her beating heart that day in that little room. It did something to me, too, watching him witness it. In the reflected blue light of the sonogram screen, I saw so many different emotions flicker across his face. Teddy always wore his feelings on his sleeve. He tried very hard to maintain a stiff upper lip, but I was pretty good at reading his eyes. I saw flashes of wonder, anger, deep pain, frustration, sadness, amazement, compassion, bittersweet longing. All of it. I wondered what he was thinking about. Was he angry with me? Did he feel insulted to even be there doing another man's duty? Did he resent me? Did he feel unable to express it as his sense of chivalry would not allow him to speak to a woman harshly, especially one who was pregnant? Did he regret the years gone by in his life when he was conquering the business world and not experiencing what his peers were at home?
Was he upset that this was how he was now forced to experience a new life, entering the world for the first time? Was he thinking about his own sons and how he never got to experience this stage of their development? Did he still feel squeamish and out of sorts because of the setting? What would he do now? What did he feel now? Was he just being a good friend? Or did he still love me? Did he even know? I didn't know if the vision of that little heart beating away mightily on that screen would push him away or propel him toward me. Both were totally plausible outcomes. All those emotions and feelings he may have had inexplicably somehow galvanized together into love, pure and simple. In that moment, he had decided to see the glass as more than half full. Whatever he saw tugged at his insides, and at mine, too. He looked directly into my face for the first time that day, and I could feel the warm sunshine of his love. It took my breath away. He smiled and pointed to the screen. "This is all we need to think about," he said. "This is all that matters." That little beating heart on the sonogram had stolen his heart, and in turn, Teddy had stolen mine for good. In many moments, what Teddy taught me the most, through his actions, much more than any business strategy or financial acumen, was unconditional love. How to receive it, and how to give it. Chapter 13. Despite the drama, the majority of my pregnancy was blissful. I had a very happy and healthy first trimester. I had no morning sickness, luckily, and even though the baby was too small to do anything, I imagined I could feel her fluttering in my tummy, almost like a tadpole swimming inside my womb. I loved the mellow buzz I felt being pregnant, like the tipsiness after a first glass of champagne. I liked my body as it rounded. I felt sexy, voluptuous in a she's-a-brick-house kind of way. I knew that pregnancy, along with my 40th birthday, less than a year away, would usher in a fundamental shift in the trajectory of my breasts, arms, and thighs. This weight gain, of course, was unlike my past fluctuations. I felt liberated from the normal worries about my figure. My body had a higher purpose. Putting on pounds wasn't just inevitable, but also necessary. So, while I still had to participate in the mental tug of war between what I wanted to eat and what I should eat, the prize of winning was no longer a flat stomach. It was a healthy baby. Vanity is a powerful force. For so long, beginning perhaps with that accidental audition at Spanish L, vanity had governed my eating habits. My vanity never quite kept me from digging into that bowl of coconut cream curry or those couple of, okay, fine, several pieces of fried chicken, but it made me feel guilty about the indulgences. Guiltily guilty, because I'm aware enough to know that my guilt is unproductive. Now, I ate for the baby, not for the reflection in my mirror. In the early days of my pregnancy, I, like so many almost moms, subsisted on a steady diet of prenatal vitamins and what-the-heck-should-I-eat-now books. The instructions were daunting, to say the least. The stakes were higher, too. No longer would my inevitable dietary lapses only reveal themselves in my butt or belly rolls. They could affect my child, too. Cooking dinner after a full day of work was hard enough without this added pressure. So I soon shelved those manuals. After all, every reliable author seemed to agree on the same strict regimen of common sense and moderation. The extent of the moderation recommended by the book surprised me, though. According to the Mayo Clinic Guide to Healthy Pregnancy, which became my pregnancy Bible, mothers-to-be need to increase their calorie intake by only 150 to 200 calories per day in their first trimester. Little more than an extra banana. A thin slice of bread with peanut butter. Or a glass of milk. Whatever happened to eating for two? As someone who had long fantasized about my next meal halfway through my current one, I was familiar with this challenge. Yet now, instead of an eat less of this, bad for me food strategy, by which one could theoretically stay slim, I adopted an eat more of these good for me meals policy, which would nourish the little person inside me. And since I was gonna gain no matter what I ate, I finally got to eat as much as I wanted, as long as the food was nourishing. Highly processed foods were out altogether. Fried chicken and its ilk would become a, quote, in case of emergency fare. I doubled down on any favorites that required minimal fussing. I roasted summer corn over my stovetop flame, channeling the street vendors in India who charred ears over charcoal near temple doors. Plenty of lemon, salt, and smoked paprika or mild chili powder added enough flavor that I never missed my typical pat of butter, which at times made me a bit queasy. I made huge salads, colorful collections of plenty of vegetables and herbs, which I kept exciting with an ever-changing array of condiments, essentially some flavorful ingredient, sherry vinegar or mustard or yuzu or yogurt, that I'd turn into dressing with very good first-press olive oil. Perhaps the most dramatic change I made in my diet was a regular addition of red meat. Aside from the no-proteins barred, eating fugues of Top Chef, I didn't eat much beef, lamb, and the rest, a lingering habit from my vegetarian childhood. Yet now I did, once a week, for the iron and calcium. I found myself relishing my weekly seared skirt steak and the task of coming up with new ways to sauce my meatballs. Some decisions weren't so straightforward. Most women renounce alcohol and caffeine. The jury is still out on whether small amounts of either one will affect your baby. Still, the choice to play it safe seems like an easy one to make. That is, until you're forced to make it. Of course I'll give it up, I thought, gliding on the winds of idealism that marked my early days of pregnancy. Next thing I knew, my eyelids would feel even heavier than my bloated body, and I'd be plodding to the corner for coffee. A tea drinker for most of my life, I switched allegiance for 9 months. I did manage to stick to one cup a day. Alcohol was easier to quit, though after the first trimester, which is the riskiest time to drink, I did enjoy a small glass of wine or champagne now and again. I was drawn to comforting foods, the foods of my childhood. Soupy mixed vegetables stewed with ground fresh coconut and curry leaves, khichdis, dishes of spiced rice and lentils, and of course my beloved yogurt and rice dish, thayir sadam. Whatever I ate, I put in a deep bowl so it was all the easier to eat with my feet up. I didn't have many ultra-specific cravings, except for cinnamon, which I mainly consumed in milky banana shakes, and, strangely enough, good old yellow mustard. When the urge struck, I was powerless. About 6 months into my pregnancy, it assaulted me on the way out of Bergdorf Goodman, where I had been attending a trunk show for the Padma collection. My mouth watered at the thought of the sharp, vinegary taste, so I made a beeline across the street to Central Park and the nearest hot dog vendor. I had been very conscientious about avoiding processed foods, but that day those steamy little links floating in their murky New York water called out to me. This was going to be my one very bad transgression. I ordered a dog piled with relish and sauerkraut, then drenched in yellow mustard. "More?" the vendor asked incredulous as I gestured at him to squirt on yet another stripe of mustard. I found the closest hilly patch of grass, plonked myself down, and devoured the thing in 4 bites. My only regret was that I hadn't ordered 2, because I then had to stand up to get a second one. This was no easy task. For my appearance at Bergdorf, I had dressed in an attempt to look chic, in black leather and heels, and gold chains and bracelets galore, though chic was becoming more and more difficult as I swelled. So when my several attempts to heave myself up failed, I ended up back on the ground, shiny legs and arms flailing, gold bangles jangling, a Mr. T-like beetle stuck on its back. For much of my pregnancy, I had continued to work out, and box, too. But Dr. Sechkin forbade me to lift heavy weights or jump or skip rope. He ordered me to go to regular weekly sonograms and was extremely concerned with the prospect of miscarriage and the baby's health in general. He became a sort of Olympic coach who checked in with me almost daily. It had been a while since he had practiced obstetrics on a regular basis, but he was watching me like a hawk. He himself had not believed it possible for me to produce this pregnancy totally naturally, and until the baby was out safely, I could tell that he would not let me out of his sight. This was, after all, his professional miracle as much as my personal one. One day in early October, somewhere in my second trimester, I went to my usual sonogram, and Sechkin saw something he didn't like. He sent me to Lenox Hill Hospital for another sonogram, and that doctor confirmed what he'd suspected. I had developed placenta previa. Previa is a condition that occurs when the baby's placenta partially or completely covers the opening of the cervix at the base or bottom of a woman's uterus. It's normally supposed to grow on the side or top of the uterus. The placenta provides all the nutrients to the baby as well as removes waste. The danger with previa is that a woman can bleed excessively before or during delivery because of the placenta's position. In any event, this was not good news at all, and provided another layer of worry for all of us. I was immediately forbidden to do any exercise of any kind. Sechkin informed me that many endo patients do suffer from previa, but that it often happens to mothers who've never had endometriosis as well. Figures I'd get this, too, I thought. Until this time, I had felt a bit of general fatigue, but I had also experienced a low-level hormonal high pretty much constantly since getting knocked up. I was a pretty happy pregnant lady. Sechkin forbade me to exert myself in any way. Sechkin is a very excitable type who gets pretty emotional, especially for a doctor who is supposed to be calm in the face of his patient's anxiety. But all that bedside manner went out the window, it seemed, when it came to me. He could not believe the insolence of my questioning. In these moments, his usual recourse was to become philosophical. "That baby in your womb is like a flower budding in the desert, a scorched desert. Now we have to stop the wind and pray for rain. Do you understand?" I understood he was calling my womb a desert, and coming from my gynecologist, this was very depressing news indeed. During one of my routine and increasing frequent checkups, I overheard two doctors speaking in solemn tones about another patient, a pregnant woman who sounded like she was in terrible health. "Previa, advanced aged, advanced endo, how horrible it all sounded. I thought about the poor woman, the complications that would surely come with her rare elderly pregnancy, imagining her brittle bones, her bruised and spotted skin, her body's imminent revolt against itself. Then one of the doctors began to spell the woman's last name. L-A-K-S-H. Wait, she was me. Those conditions were the titles of my miseries. Mine, I learned, was a geriatric pregnancy. I knew my pregnancy was high risk. Given my age and the late date at which we finally found out I was really pregnant, I worried about the health of the baby. Had I gotten enough folic acid? Would my endometriosis be a hindrance to this baby's coming out okay? Given the fact that I had only one fallopian tube on one side and one working ovary on the other, had the embryo even implanted properly? So I focused instead on a less dire worry. How to stay active, for my physical and mental health. I've long been a gym rat, and up until that appointment, I had expected to continue my boxing, spinning, and the rest. When Sechkin commanded otherwise, I picked his brain for alternatives. Running was a no-no. So was lifting any weights over a measly 3 pounds. I couldn't jump or bounce or jostle. "Can I even walk?" I asked, frustrated. "Yes, you can walk," he said. "Well, can I walk upstairs?" "Yes." "Aha!" I started on the stairs at the gym, walking up and down the 2 flights about 15 to 20 times, but soon stopped. I felt silly and self-conscious, like I was always blocking traffic.
Instead, I took to walking the emergency stairs in my apartment building, a fire exit stairwell encased in dingy, bare cement walls connected the floors. There were no windows, no people, no distractions. I walked up slowly and steady, skipping one stair with each step. When I traveled for Top Chef, Michelle would help me suss out each hotel's emergency stairs. I listened to music on an iPod at first, but I quickly abandoned music for the rhythmic echo of my footsteps, the cadence of my breath. The stairwell came to serve as a sort of flotation chamber, except that my mind, not my body, needed stilling. Outside of my cement cocoon, my thoughts churned. What am I going to tell people? How am I going to wedge motherhood into my life? Then how am I going to wedge my life into motherhood? And how am I going to fit into my clothes? I admit that I started my slow climbs out of vanity, as a reaction to the desperation I felt when I looked in the mirror and saw my newly bloated body and contourless face. But my daily ascents and descents began to take on a meditative quality. I spent 25 to 45 minutes a day on stairs, depending on the time I had to spare or how much I could bear. Sometimes I realized that the beads of salty water streaking my face were not sweat but tears. It was in these scattered stairwells that I waded through hormone-fueled emotion and egocentric impulse. It was in these stairwells that I came to understand that the time for self-indulgence was over. That my primary purpose now was ensuring the health of the creature growing inside me. That I'd soon be a helpless little person's only succor. I rarely looked forward to a session on the stairs, but once I emerged, blinking at the brightness of the day, I felt happy to have done it. Then, in mid-December, I felt a dull cramping. Nothing outrageous or comparable to when I had my period, but definitely there. This startled me because I hadn't had a cramp since becoming pregnant. I called Sechkin, who asked me to meet him in his office. When I got there, he determined I was having early contractions, and he said we needed to go to the hospital. This rocked me to the core. Up until that time, I had pretty much managed to keep my good humor in spite of everything. But the moment Sechkin announced that I might have to be admitted, I felt a sudden helplessness and impotence I had never felt before. An invisible rock formed under my sternum, a heavy ball of dread I could not shake. The ride from Sechkin's office to Lenox Hill Hospital is a short one, a mere handful of New York City blocks, but it seemed like an eternity. I felt like a prisoner, waiting to be executed. Adam had yet to decide the correct course of action or determine his desired involvement in the baby's life. On the way to the hospital, I phoned to inform him of what was developing. He was in Texas. He did not come to New York. At the hospital, nurses and other staff struggled to get an IV in me. I became mostly mute and stone-faced as the doctors discussed giving me steroids to expand the baby's lungs in case she did come early. Right now, her lungs weren't developed enough for her to breathe on her own, they explained. They gave me medication to stop the contractions, a drug used for heart patients that worked on the muscles of the heart but also calmed other organs, in my case, my uterus. I had extremely low blood pressure, so they monitored not only my heart but the baby's too. I had pads and patches and tubes, taped to various parts of my body, and I felt more like a science experiment than a patient. I felt utterly immobilized, paralyzed with fear. I pushed back the only thoughts I had, which were that this was happening because of my emotional callousness. For most of my life, I had been a serial monogamist. Perhaps this was my punishment for acting like a female Casanova. But why punish the baby? Karma was a big part of my beliefs as a Hindu. So when I first found out about my pregnancy, I immediately attributed it to good karma for starting the foundation with Sechkin. Now I considered my current plight also a result of karma. It didn't altogether make sense, and I was afraid of delving even deeper into my thoughts, lest I create some further turmoil in my system. I was too afraid to let my mind wander, and so I mostly stared out the window of my hospital room. People kept bustling in and out for the better part of the rest of the evening.